We are very well suited by having our first two speakers, who are both graduates of the police executive program, address the issues of evidence from two different perspectives. And the first one is from the view of the person who speaks with and on behalf of all of the 43 chief constables and many other chief officers at the assistant and deputy level who are leading the police organizations of England and Wales. Please welcome Sarah Thornton, the chair of the National Police Chiefs Council.
Larry, thank you very much indeed. And it's great to be back in Cambridge. I've just spent half an hour in the library, and I have many happy memories from 2010 and 2000 of hours spent in that library. Your conference title today is Transforming the Police with Evidence-Based Police Capability. And I think it's right just to kind of put a couple of comments before I start. The first is, in terms of transforming policing, in terms of building evidence-based capability, I just want to pay tribute to the work of Cambridge and Larry in particular. And I think that kind of tour around the world of people in the room was a fantastic demonstration of the fact that you're not just building evidence-based practice in the United Kingdom, but actually helping to build it throughout the world. And so thank you very much for that. The second thing I want to do is just explain what I thought I might do today. Larry and I, as ever, haggled over the theme, because the first title he gave me sounded like a master's dissertation in itself. But I thought what I might do is talk about the national transformation and reform work that I've been involved in over the last couple of years as chair of my body, working with police and crime commissioners, but with the Home Office, with the College of Policing, with the National Crime Agency, and other organisations at that national level. Talk a little bit about it, but just reflect on what that might mean in terms of change. And to try and answer this question, which I hope will be clear in a minute about what I mean, does service-led mean evidence-led? And I say this all in the context of policing, certainly still in this country, is very much a local effort. The identity of local police forces, the budget, the leadership, the democratic accountability, all very local. And of course, given the way in which many of us are now dealing with issues which are transnational, when so much of our work is digital, and that of course is a challenge, and I hope that will be a kind of a theme that becomes apparent. So let's start. Cut this out. Where did this idea come about self-reforming? Well, this goes back to nearly 2 years ago. The Home Secretary, as she was, Prime Minister now, came to a conference of chiefs and police and crime commissioners and talked about the fact that she had done her bit on police reform and now it was over to us. That was the chiefs and the police and crime commissioners. And this sort of ideology, this orthodoxy, which is very much about the Home Office didn't know best, but that actually local people, local operational chiefs knew best. And if you think about it, what had happened in this country from 2010 till 2015, she had established several new institutions, the College of Policing, the National Crime Agency, and of course, Police and Crime Commissioners, which were a radical change to systems of governance. So a massive amount of top-down change. But in 2015, there was this message which was over to you. And I think I was thinking about this slide in the context of the discussions in the newspapers today and yesterday with Theresa May now saying, you know, can the Labour Party and the other opposition parties help her govern? And of course the analysis is, well, that's because they've run out of ideas. I suppose you could have said that she'd done this once before. but actually wasn't just the Home Secretary. This is Brandon Lewis, who's no longer the police minister, but he was until about a month ago. And he first started talking about this sense of sector being self-reforming, scanning for the long term, thinking about how we might self-reform. So this was a kind of policy idea that was going being promulgated and has been for the last couple of years. And I suppose you could argue that it's ideological, there is a sense in which a writer-centred government will take a more laissez-faire, hands-off approach. They'd also done their bit, and now they've, you know, they've built up particularly the role of police and crime commissioners. What could they then do to have change which was driven, I guess, by kind of those local relationships rather than a top-down Whitehall-led change? So there was something that was ideological. There's also something which is deeply political about it, because as many officials in the Home Office have said to me, of course, it's a great answer if a Home Secretary or a Police Minister is asked difficult questions about policing, and they say, well, that's not for me to answer. You need to ask your local Police and Crime Commissioner or your local Chief Constable. So kind of politically, it can be useful. I guess it, in some ways it de-risks some of the difficult issues of policing for them. And I guess for me, the reason why it's clever is that you might say that the very obvious response to transnational crime, globalisation, digitisation is fewer police forces, fewer larger police forces. And of course, that has just been so not on the agenda in this country for a long time. But actually, what you do need to do, however, is to get the service to come together, to work together in a kind of voluntary capacity rather than enforcing amalgamations or mandating change. So kind of there is some sense to it. But I've just been talking to a Swedish colleague, and we had the Dutch commissioner came over to see my chief constable colleagues in April. Of course, two countries there where actually there have been those local approaches subject to national amalgamation over the last 3 or 4 years. So I think this is a kind of a delicate sort of tiptoe through those issues. And of course, we all know, is David Weisbird here yet? I'm going to quote him, so he's not here. But, you know, we do know how resistant our departments are to change and that we often experience difficulty. I think that's an understatement in implementing new programmes. So, you know, again, this sense in which actually this idea of self-reforming makes a lot of sense. So that's the political context, and I hope for those of you who aren't England and Welsh police officers on staff understand enough about why we're in this place that we're in. So this was the kind of the mood music in 2015, and working with colleagues, you know, we were saying, well, we need to think about how we're going to change and reform, and of course everybody quite rightly says, well, we need to have some sort of vision, we need to have some sense of where we're going to, which is why we started work nearly 2 years ago on Vision 2025. And we eventually did. I mean, I was, to be honest, very sceptical that we would ever get all chiefs and police and crime commissioners to sign up to something which was kind of broadly an aspiration. But we did by the end of 2016. Five key areas to it. First one, if I start at the top and work clockwise, local policing. The key words there, we seek greater kind of integration, greater alignment, greater join-up. Greater focus on vulnerability, which probably won't surprise you. In terms of specialist capabilities, this sense in which, particularly new and complex threats, we need to operate much more as a network, that it's not about kind of siloed capability, but that we need to find new ways for sharing capability, for sharing expertise. Then working down, enabling business delivery, how much more should we be doing in terms of interoperability, particularly around technology and the big technology platforms, but also around procurement. Digital, I always say about digital, every single police force has got to develop a digital response to the public, has got to develop ways to deal with digital intelligence and evidence, and has got to work out a way to get that digital material digitally to the prosecutors for the court process. And some forces can afford to do that, maybe. Some forces I don't think can. And why would we ever do it 43 times? We need to work out ways to do that together, which I think is powerful in logic, but difficult in delivery sometimes. And lastly, the fifth area, workforce. And the key words there are about representativeness, around making sure we've got the right skills, experience to meet challenging, but also very much changing requirements. So eventually we did get a vision agreed, and we launched it jointly with Police and Crime Commissioners at the end of 2016. We did one thing to help with this, and then the government did something which has sort of been helpful. The first is that we agreed with the Police and Crime Commissioners that we would form a joint board, the Police Reform and Transformation Board, which a few, Alex Marshall, for example, from the college sits on, a mixture of Police and Crime Commissioners and Chiefs. We had no power It's completely kind of unofficial body, but we felt that we could do some work together to try and encourage initiatives that developed the achievement of this vision. That was what we did. We thought it was a very sensible way forward, and in fact that group has developed nicely over the last 18 months. The Home Office then decided, actually, if you've got this vision, if you've got this joint working, which was the first time we'd really had it, and not with the Home Office in the chair, but with Police and Crime Commissioners and Chiefs in the chair, there was some sense in asking this body to help advise on how to spend transformational funds that the Home Office had from Treasury. And that was the beginning of the Police Transformation Fund. Those of you who've done partnership work in whatever country, I suspect, in my experience, it's always great having committees with people from different organisations working together. As soon as there's money on the table, it sort of makes things better because it facilitates what you might want to do, but it also means you end up talking about money a lot of the time, and this has been no different. But this year, we've been advising the Home Secretary on the spend. It's 175 million, so it's quite a lot of money. There's lots of paperwork, lots of bureaucracy, lots of caveats, but actually there is a reasonable amount of fund which Home Office officials and indeed ministers want our help on. So then you have the new Home Secretary saying policing's taken an important step forward to become a self-reforming sector at pace. So there we are, she's using the words as well. The Police Reform and Transformation Board has helped deliver two rounds of competed funding, and we have the ambition with the National Policing Vision 2025. As the police-led process of transformation evolves and matures, it's quite right there is a move to greater commissioning. So we've done quite a bit of work, and then you've got there the kind of the political message saying, you know, happy with what you're doing. And for all those reasons about my analysis earlier on, you might not be surprised. So, okay, so we have a great opportunity. All of us in policing complain loudly, don't we, when politicians set up initiatives and plans which have no evidence base whatsoever. They're just because they've kind of met somebody or they've heard something. So now it's over to the service. Can we be any better at basing our activities on the evidence? I'm just going to quote, I've used this before, Archie Cochrane's very early work back in the 70s, which was about expenditure in the health service, about thinking about what the benefit was to the population, what the benefit was to the public. He was arguing in terms of money and whether you would want to spend more money on the health service. And so with that in mind, that sense of, you know, what is the benefit, one of the first things we have done is work out from our vision what are our outcomes. And I won't go into any great detail, but, you know, again, keywords: more proactive and preventative policing, intelligent deployment of local resources, network capabilities, high quality service, seamless modern channels, capture analysis and sharing data at speed, core infrastructure, digital platforms, consolidated professional back office, integrated services, and again, of course, diverse, motivated, and capable workforce. So kind of some themes there about this is what we think we will be delivering if we get to Vision 2025. So there is some attempt, we've made some attempt to think about what the benefits might be, and there's a whole load of analysis behind that, as you might expect. So, okay, so how have we got on in terms of, I'm going to use two definitions. I'm going to use Pfeffer and Sutton, which I often use, and then I'm going to use Larry Sherman, which is a much more demanding standard, I think. So if my standard is Pfeffer and Sutton from the Harvard Business Review, evidence-based management, notice a slight difference, distinct mindset that clashes with the way many managers and companies operate, so we put aside belief, wisdom, dangerous half-truths, and we have an unrelenting commitment to gather the necessary facts to make more informed and intelligent decisions. And I would argue that if the test is gathering facts to make more informed and intelligent decisions, we are making some progress on that. If, however, the definition is the Sherman higher standard, evidence-based policing in terms of what works, I think we're okay on the first bit about what practices and strategies accomplish police missions, because we have tried to think about outcomes, what are we trying to achieve? But I think in terms of an approach which continually tests hypotheses with empirical research findings, we've got some way to go. But I think that in terms of the use of fact and evidence, we are in a better place. Now, why do I say that? Well, this is the can of worm. I mean, this looks really complicated. I'm a little funnel here. But in terms of, you know, what are the priorities for the spend of this profile, which is kind of stage five at the right, you know, we start with having some principles under the stage one. We start with thinking about what the profile of the fund, you know, what are we trying to do? We then spend a lot of time with SMEs, subject matter experts, thinking about, you know, what are the things, what are the building blocks, what are the activities that are going to take us to the vision that's going to take us to, to this outcome. So we started off with like massive spreadsheets, 110 of those, focused down more on total number of building blocks, then got down to about 20, and the board looked at all 20, we scored them, and then we're down to six. So there has been a kind of process. The priorities that we think, the gaps that we think we've got, are not just because somebody has promoted their own hobby horse. It's been a desire to actually think about, starting from that, those outcomes, where do we think the gaps are. And so apart from the work that's in train, which I'll talk about in a minute, these are the sorts of things that we think that we need to be doing an awful lot more about. And I'll just pick out a couple of them. One of which is the policing data strategy and foundations. What does that mean? Well, I think that in policing, we just have not got our heads around how important data is. We tend to talk about technology, we talk about platforms, but actually our ability to understand data and the importance of that, I think we're in the foothills. When we talk about technology standards, I've been corrected several times in the last sort of 6 months about this, because actually the biggest issue is technology standards, yes, technical ones, architecture standards, but actually data standards are what really matters, because if we're going to be working together, if we're going to be interoperable, actually the way in which we address data, you know, even the kind of the classifications we use, we need to be much more consistent. These things, like, quite boring maybe, but if we're going to be interoperable, if we're going to deliver the vision together, these things are important. Another one, video-enabled justice platforms, that's really interesting. You will all maybe be aware that the court service have been experimenting, their vision is to be digital by default, but very much experimenting with just how much of their work can be done online, just how much of the work can be video-enabled. And there's a whole range of initiatives there. And the issue for the police service very often is that, yes, we could do all court remand hearings from custody blocks, which is what they'd like to do, but the cost to police forces of that is enormous, and the benefits are rather unclear. So before we kind of race down that, let's do some proper piloting work to say, if we're going to do it properly in a small area, let's work out where the costs and the benefits lie. And actually, it sounds very attractive, but does it really make sense right across the piece? So some kind of important work there. And then one other issue that I'll pick out is the knowledge sharing network model. And again, you know, there's work being done on that. The College of Policing does work with its POLCA system, with its authorised professional practice website. The ICT company's got a knowledge hub. But you know, we're very poor in policing, certainly in this country, of sharing knowledge, of understanding, you know, where to go. It's very kind of dislocated, and so we need to do an awful lot more of that. And I think it's not just about a database, it's about a much more comprehensive approach to organisational learning and how we do that. So kind of these are the sorts of things that we are working on. I just want to say a little bit about three of the existing priorities. I mentioned digital, which I think is really important. We have three aspects of the digital policing programme. Public contact, really, really important. More and more of our contact with the public is digital, but not nearly enough. The challenges around number two, digital investigation intelligence, you know, just how much material is now digital. You know, if you think about it, I'll talk a minute about cyber-dependent crime, but at the other end of the scale, just about every crime now has some sort of digital footprint, and our ability to capture and store and share that digital material varies across the country enormously. And moving to number three, digital first, there's still far too many places where actually digital evidence means putting things onto a disc and driving in a car to the prosecutors with the disc. So real challenges around digital. And it's for me, this is just where the world has changed so much in the last 5 years, and we are struggling, I think, to catch up in any way. So that's a top priority. We have a program on that, thinking through all those three areas. Then we also, these are the boring platforms, but I think the ROI, the return on investment, are potentially substantial here. We're doing three big pieces of work where you've got what we call productivity services. So basically, that's all the stuff like your email, your kind of use of Excel, whatever you're doing in terms of video conferencing, all the stuff will be on the desktop. We call those productivity services. If we're going to go to something like Microsoft Office 365, which is on kind of public cloud, it makes no sense for 30-odd forces to be speaking to Microsoft. We're working up an offer which all forces will do it, linked with identity access management. What does that mean? Basically, at the moment in this country, if I go out of the Met, because I'm on the Met system, and go, in fact, if I tried to go on the Cambridge system where we are today, I would not be able to. I would have to go back to London to get a laptop, and then I could go on remotely. This is just crazy. So we need to have some sort of access management which is kind of blind to the boundaries of forces. Security operations, most forces are not doing enough to protect their own data, their own systems. We need to build a security operations centre together. Quite a lot of forces just would not be able to afford to do it on their own. And the last is the cloud infrastructure, and thinking very carefully about how much of our material, most of our data is stored currently in bricks and mortar, in data centres, in police buildings. In the future, a lot of that can go on secure cloud, but an awful lot can probably go on public cloud as well. So thinking about how we do that together. If you look at the figures, you know, policing is really struggling in terms of money. But if we could just make these investments, look at the 10-year benefits, that's if we stop procuring all this stuff separately and trying to do it on our own and do it together. And the third area, I was going to just give you an example. I mentioned cyber-dependent crime. I've been leading some work on capabilities with Chris Sims, who a lot of you know. And what we're looking at is some of the more specialist capabilities, which maybe have a high requirement for expertise. We might use them reasonably irregularly. Location doesn't matter that much. How much more could we share these? And what we've been doing is some very detailed data-driven work on this. And I'll just give you one example here, cyber-dependent crime. So these are the crimes like ransomware attacks, malware attacks, DDoS attacks, the sorts of crimes that didn't exist before the internet existed. So I'm not talking about some of the sort of fraud scams. Look at what's happening. This is the data that we collected earlier this year. According to the Crime Survey of England and Wales, about 2 million of these cyber-dependent crimes a year. Actually, only 18,000 are going through to action fraud. I think most members of the public don't realise they can report them to the police. And of those 18,000, only 3,300 allocated to forces by NFIB, sorry, the National Fraud Intelligence Bureau. And of those, only 1,100 ending up as crimes and only 400 being investigated. That is a massive attrition. So what we're trying to do, you know, whenever you try and persuade chiefs and police and crime commissioners that they need to develop new capabilities, it's a tough call. But using some of the data to say, look, there is a real issue here. There is a massive under response nationally. And what's interesting, when we've looked into what's causing the attrition at the very bottom in those yellow bits, we noticed that about a quarter of forces, when they get the referral, just say no further action, whereas only about 4% of the regional units do. Now, there might be lots of explanations for that, but what worries me is one explanation is that some forces just don't know what to do with these referrals when they get them, because it's quite special stuff. So this is a kind of a key area we need to keep up, and so what we're saying is, actually we need to set some force regional and national levels, and we must create convergence in skills, process and technology so we can protect the public. So again, these words about convergence, you know, all these words, which I guess are ways in which we're mitigating the fact that we're 43. So And there's just one other example. I put this in here. The Green Book is, some of you, who knows what the Green Book is? Okay, right. The Green Book is like the Treasury, Her Majesty's Treasury rules on if you're going to invest public money, how much justification you need to make. So there's no shortage of data. So every kind of full business case needs to have a strategic case, an economic case, a commercial case, a financial case, and a management case. So there's no kind of shortage of data here. But this isn't evidence-based. This is kind of justification. This is about spending money. And so I think that, you know, the challenge for us here is it's not that there's lack of writing, it's not that there's a lack of report, but actually how do we make sure that we are kind of using the data, using the information to build better outcomes and results. So just to kind of try and pull this together, how are we doing? We've got the challenge from the officials and from the Home Secretary to be self-reforming. And Chris was doing some work on this, and we were just reflecting on how difficult it is to have a unified change programme when you've got 86 sovereign bodies, so that's 43 chiefs and 43 police and crime commissioners, who start from different places, who do not share a detailed understanding of the destination, who exist in a normal state of competitive rivalry. I don't know whether you recognise that, but certainly forces start from very different places, which means national change is always very difficult. We have tried our best to have a joint understanding of destination, but it's not straightforward. And I think forces do exist in a normal state of competitive rivalry. Some of that is very, very natural, and some of it, though, is a result of political decisions to try and put forces in league tables. So what does that mean? How do we maintain localism when so much of the modern threat is global? One of the problems we have about self-performing is always trying to do things nationally. We end up using consultants too much, probably, because most of the good people are in police forces. The point about benefits, that point I made about video enabled justice, if you're trying to do national change, how do you deal with those really important issues about benefits and cost? Because they often don't fall then in the same place when you're doing national change. Really. And the other thing that struck me more and more, having sort of worked at the centre now, is that even if you have a national programme, like the replacement of the airwave radio with the emergency services network, which we're in the grips of doing, that's a massive Home Office programme. But actually, all the benefits realisation is going to have to be in police forces. And that's really difficult for a central programme to do, because actually the take-up and the utilisation is going to really matter in forces. Legal ambiguity. The reality is all we have in terms of accountability is legal agreements called Section 22 collaboration agreements. If you're doing things nationally, there's no one person accountable, and that can be really quite tricky. Poor agility. I showed you the Green Book, how complex that is. The bureaucracy in national change is substantial. We are trying our best to work with Home Office to make it more, I wouldn't ever call it agile, but a little more streamlined. But it is really, really tricky. And it makes me realise, actually, having been in a policing kind of world for 30 years, which is more around kind of a local government approach, it is slightly more agile than kind of the white ball approach. It's very, very bureaucratic. And lastly, in terms of collaboration and working together, you have very different reasons for people working together, and it's quite crowded. So, some places people are working together because of austerity, maybe working with local partners just to do things more cheaply. Similarly, at a regional level, might be collaborating because you get a greater economy of scale, and some of it's national, like the digital infrastructure we're trying to build. So, lots of really significant challenges. And so kind of politically, we think to ourselves, what are the options to deal with this? I've talked about fewer, larger forces. That's politically challenging. It's not going to happen. Do we want the Home Office to tell us what to do? Probably not. Do we want more regulation? Probably not. And in fact, the reality is that there was no legislation proposed in the Queen's speech on policing. as long as this government lasts, there will not be any legislation on policing, because policing is only England and Wales, and therefore he can't help out because of English votes for English laws. Secondly, they only take two or three people to two or three Conservatives to not vote with the government, and they've got a problem. So they're just, my assessment is they're just going to steer clear. There's nothing there. So that's not going to happen. There's not going to be stronger regulation. So we're into refining the current system. We are building a better capability centrally. We are always trying to go with what I call, what we call the coalition of the willing, rather than forced change, and also getting people to think more about what we call a mutual mindset. How can we think much more about policing as a network, respecting the fact that there are 86 sovereign bodies, but we are in fact a network. The public regard us as a network, and therefore surely we should regard ourselves as a network. And some of the things that we've thought about is whether we could do more work with the private sector for faster implementation, and whether in fact we need a much more substantial organisation, which Peter, I thought sounded like the MPIA, the bottom point. There we go. Nothing changes. Really substantial kind of questions there. You know, if you look at those three columns, I think it's only the middle one. I think we're only into refining the current system. That's where we are at the moment. So I'm just going to finish. So having kind of shared my journey over the last couple of years and shared some of the dilemmas, I just wanted to finish on a couple of reflections I had from last week on how far we've got in terms of evidence-based policing and building the capability. And they're both, Alex, from college things that I was reading last week. The first is there was a draft role profile, a professional profile for constables, which the college were beginning to consult on. And I was really interested to see for the first time ever that one of the descriptors was saying that increasingly constables are individually responsible for determining, applying, and evaluating practice based on best available evidence, known as evidence-based policing. So that was there. So, and it struck me that if we're really serious about this, that there's two sorts of ways that we can progress. It's the individual and the organisational. And it seems to me the individual way is the one that actually is gathering pace. All of you in this room are testament to that. But if we can get it agreed that that's what constables should be thinking about, then I think the individual responsibility is helpful. So that made me quite optimistic and positive. Later on in the meeting, however, I was looking, and there was a paper on evidence-based guidelines, there were two pilot areas, officer safety and investigative interviewing, probably very good areas to think about evidence-based guidelines. But it just seemed to me it was going to take so long. And we've got this committee, the college has got a committee which is going to look at this, and they're only looking at two. And I thought, you know, it'll take us 100 years to go through all the policies we've got if we go at this rate. So, you know, the institutional, organisational challenges are enormous. But I think, if anything, it illustrates to me the importance of individuals understanding it. And if not, passing the Larry Sherman test about testing hypotheses, at least ensuring that whenever we're approaching change, that we relentlessly demand fact and evidence and data as we put our plans together. On that note, I'll finish. Thank you.